Good morning. Are counsel ready?
Yes.
Please proceed.
I believe Mr. DeSimone would like to make introductions. Mr. DeSimone is going to make the argument for the appellees.
Fine.
Good morning. My name is Mary Dugan. I'm here on behalf of the appellees to introduce Mr. DeSimone, who's been admitted pro hoc vice in this court. I also have with us Mr. Christian Wright and Ms. Michelle Annunziata, also of Mayor Brown.
Thank you. Welcome to the court.
Morning. May it please the court. John Reed for the appellants, whom I will refer to as the defendants throughout the argument. Present with me at counsel table is my partner, Denise Kraft, and also present in the back of the courtroom is one of the appellants, Mr. Luca Mina. If it's all right with the court, I've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal time. I know the court's been through the briefs, and I know the court knows what this case is about, so let me begin by saying this. Everyone is in agreement that judges need broad discretion to control what goes on in their courtrooms, both the lawyers and the litigants. It's an important part of the system, and it's good for everyone involved. That said, judges are human, and occasionally they do make mistakes, and we believe that's what happened here. Now, this is it's a very uncomfortable case, and what we're asking you to do, we know, requires a real basis. And so for the next couple of minutes, while I talk about the facts, it may well sound that I'm making the appellee's case here, because I think there's a lot of things we need to concede. We have a heavy burden. We have to show that the vice chancellor acted arbitrarily and capriciously. So let me turn to the record. And let me also be clear. We are not in any way suggesting that the defendants did nothing wrong here. To the contrary, they did several things wrong, and I'm going to talk about them. This whole situation got off to a very bad start because the parties never should have entered into a settlement agreement that required $10 million in payments in a very short period of time when both sides knew that the company did not have $10 million sitting in a bank account and it was going to require the sale of certain assets to make those payments. Nonetheless, they signed it with that knowledge. I just make a couple citations to the record, A-764. Now, let me just turn to what I think is the very first bad thing that the defendants did in this case. When the settlement broke down at the first office conference on December 30th, 2008,
let me interrupt. When you say the settlement broke down, there was already an executed settlement agreement, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. At December 5th, it was executed. The payments were already in default by the end of the month. At December 30th, the vice chancellor asked a question about what had happened to the first escrow payment. And in the transcript, that transcript is at A31 to 51. In that transcript, counsel says, we haven't really focused on the escrow account information. But then he goes on to provide an explanation to the vice chancellor anyway. And he clearly gets it wrong. He makes a misrepresentation about numbers being interposed and the wire going through but being rejected. It's not what happened. The wire had been set up so that when the company got a payment, the wire would then go out. The company never got the payment. The explanation for that is in the record at AR-222 to AR-223 and A-211 to 215. Nonetheless, a misrepresentation was made. The second bad thing that the defendants did,
and
also,
what was the date of that?
That was December 30th.
Okay.
Second bad thing they did also occurred on December 30th. Without fully explaining how the settlement agreement operates to the vice chancellor, and the vice chancellor doesn't really know at that point. Why would he? Prior counsel makes a statement implying that the two individuals are going to own the assets that are being transferred under the settlement agreement. As a matter of fact, it's even worse than an implication. It's not even fair for me to use that word. This is exactly what counsel says to the vice chancellor. Mina and Garoni would end up owning everything in Atlantic Coal. Now, the settlement agreement had been executed 3 weeks prior to that. The settlement agreement is very clear that this Carbon Power is going to get these assets, not Mina and Garoni. We have no explanation for why he said it. We don't know if the fact that he was dealing with these two individuals and that was the face he put on the company and he misspoke, but it was clearly a misrepresentation, indisputably. But the agreement was clear. At that time, they were never going to get that. So, again, the vice chancellor had no way of knowing that. You wouldn't expect the vice chancellor to know all the intricacies of the settlement agreement. So The vice chancellor was told something else.
Between the two of them, they were 100% owners of Carbon Power. Right?
As of that point, they were not.
They were not?
They did not own Carbon Power at all. So the defense got off to a really bad start. 21 days later, this case spirals out of control. There's a motion to compel filed by the defendants, and defendants do the third wrong thing here. They never file a formal opposition to that. Counsel shows up at an office conference on January 20th, 2009. That transcript's in the record at 852 to 60, where the court rejects their objections to having to produce all kinds of personal financial information, and also orders up the stream information about all the ownership of the stockholders of Carbon Power. Now, prior to this, as of January 13th, the defendants have already started producing company documents, such as bank accounts, tax returns, balance sheets. But now they have to start producing personal financial information, and they have to do it within 10 days. They also have to produce all this up the stream information. That's at pages 3 and 4 of that particular transcript. This is where prior counsel begins to panic, given the short time frame. This is where the clients start to get very, very concerned that all their personal financial information is going to be out there, yet they've got no payment responsibilities under the agreement. It's also the point where we start to take issue with some of the sharp language about the defendants supposedly disregarding what the Court of Chancery wanted. Counsel immediately spent 2 days in Washington, 3 days traveling to and then working in Italy and traveling back, 3 days in Florida, gathering documents with the assistance of a technology consultant. That's in the record at AR 226 to 229. By January 29th, defendant Garoni has produced all of her tax returns, personal bank statements, and deeds to properties. By the next day, January 30th, she produces 900 pages of emails. And remember, this is discovery supposedly on a motion to enforce a settlement agreement where the issue is who constitutes an affiliate. You know, during the deposition of the plaintiffs, counsel instructed his client not to answer a question about what his client thought affiliates meant. That would have been particularly relevant, but you can't find a single complaint in the record from the vice chancellor being concerned about that, because at this point, he was already upset that this settlement had broken down and this case wasn't going away. Now, this is where the defendants get into real trouble, because now it's January 30th, and they're out of time. The court said 10 days. And that's it. And that's wrong number four. Despite the effort, at this point, they continue to move forward. They produce they start producing 3,500 pages of emails from MENA, bank statements, tax returns, personal property appraisals. On February 6th, Garoni's deposed. Now, her deposition had been delayed. Her deposition had been delayed because when she was getting ready to come to the U.S., she discovered her passport had expired. Now, there's talk in the record about that explanation being ridiculous. Now, I've known people who've shown up at the airport without a passport, forgetting it. I've known people who've shown up at the airport with expired passports. I don't think there's anything unusual about the fact that at the last minute in getting ready to come to the U.S., she discovered her passport expired and the deposition had to be delayed. But saying the defendants failed to show up for depositions, Is this not a correct characterization? We've all been in situations where, or at least many of us have, in situations where we're sitting at a...
Let me cut through that.
Yes.
It seems to me that that's a pretty simple yes or no kind of thing. Either she shows up, you know, she shows a passport that is recently expired and a brand new one that coincides with these dates, or she doesn't.
That's right. And ultimately, when she did show up for deposition, there was no inquiry into that. And I tried to find this morning a copy in this voluminous record of her passport because it was produced. But there's no question her passport expired. Counsel immediately worked with her to get a new one quickly. And she shows up in the United States on February 6th and is deposed. Now we're to February 11th. Now, of course, we're now 10 days beyond where the vice chancellor wanted all the discovery complete. And this is where wrong number five occurs, because this is where Mr. MENA gets deposed. And the reason I say this is a particularly problematic issue for us is because what occurs next is really what caused delay here. He refuses to disclose who was the buyer of the stock in Carbon Power. And the reason he does it is because it's done pursuant to a purchase agreement that has a very strict confidentiality clause in it, so strict that the purchaser didn't even let him keep a copy. All he knew is it was that important, and he didn't have the precise language, but he knew it was governed by the laws of another country and that he wasn't able to disclose even the existence of the agreement itself. Now, we now know that that buyer was Busani Enterprises. Of course, Mr. Mean is afraid. He's not a lawyer. He's not familiar with the U.S. system. He has no understanding of how quickly the vice chancellor wants to move here and how upset the vice chancellor was that this whole case wasn't going away.
Well, excuse me. You say that Mr. Mina is not a lawyer, but he was represented, right?
Absolutely.
And his attorneys did explain to him what the situation was in terms of what was proceeding in this court.
Absolutely. And he didn't have a copy of the agreement. And the party that did, he couldn't get it. He tried to offer on February 2nd, I believe, to produce the thing on the condition that he'd make a representation to Busani that it will only be produced in camera. That was rejected. Ultimately, it was produced. We get involved in the case
Wait a second. How is it that something that's so confidential that, you know, everything's going to fall apart if somebody learns this name, now we know the name. What happened?
Well, the agreement was produced pursuant to a confidentiality agreement. Apparently, Busani decided that it would be okay to disclose their name. Mina didn't know that at the time. He certainly knows it now. And look, Your Honor, I'm not trying to make excuses here. All I'm saying is here's a foreigner. He knows he's bound by this agreement. He doesn't have the language in front of him. He's trying to assert it in a way that he thinks nobody's listening to him. And it clearly, without a doubt, caused delay. We get involved in the case on February 19th. And my first reaction is, I don't know what to do about this agreement because I haven't seen it. I have no idea how confidential this is. But I do know one thing. This is a Delaware corporation. And the plaintiffs are entitled to know who owns the stock in this company. And so I tell them, we have to at least disclose the name, and we need to produce something. We produce the stock certificates that show that Busani Enterprises owns the company. Whether or not they can have a side agreement on the purchase that remains confidential is a whole other issue, and I think that's debatable. But we certainly were obligated to disclose who the stockholders were. And that was ultimately done, albeit very late. We show up at the pretrial conference on February 24th, and at that point, the court is my first interaction with the court in the case, and I understand how upset the vice chancellor is. He cancels the trial. He says your clients are going to be redeposed, and I want the Busani agreement produced, and I want all the upstream information about the ownership produced. I can't argue with the fact that the court was clearly entitled to sanction the defendants under those circumstances. It's ultimately the workings of it that we find problematic. The court ordered payment of all the fees incurred by the plaintiffs to date, entered an order on March 2nd saying that if all the fees aren't paid within 2 weeks, he's going to default them in the case. Ultimately, $10 million on an agreement that, if you read it, you'll see that they're not the payer under the agreement. Now, the defendants conceded that $426,000 of those fees were reasonable in accordance with the court's award. Plaintiffs were demanding $700,000. Defendants did not have that kind of personal wherewithal. Most people don't have that kind of personal wherewithal. And ultimately, the court entered a default judgment on the entire case, awarded $10 million on the settlement agreement, and awarded $700,000 in fees because the defendants refused to pay the first could not pay the first $426,000.
And what should the court have done? Just keep on giving you a few more chances and a few more slaps on the wrist?
No, Your Honor. This is what I think. I think that the court should have struck a balance between appropriately sanctioning these defendants, but also adhering to the goal of resolving a dispute on the merits. What we suggested to the court was, do a reasonableness review of the remaining $300,000 in fees, and then enter a judgment on those fees and let the plaintiffs pursue it, and let's proceed to the merits of the case. I'm willing to stand on what we said in the briefs about whether the court needed to conduct a reasonableness review of the remaining $300,000 in fees, the difference between the $426,000 and the $7,000. I think what's really important is to turn to what is our second issue, and it's our critical issue, and that is, did the totality of the circumstances here warrant a $10 million default judgment? No documents were destroyed. No documents were, you know, concealed and later discovered. The defendants produced over 7,000 pages of information in a very, very short period of time in a case where all that was at issue was money. They're foreigners. They clearly did not understand the significance of all of it, and their lawyers were overwhelmed. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Producing all that information through the holidays involving Florida, D.C., and Italy in 10 days was all very difficult. They tried. They didn't do it. They did not succeed.
Well, the record shows that your clients are very sophisticated international business people, right?
Mr. Mina is. Ms. Garoni, she had been out of the company for over 2 years. She's not particularly sophisticated. She has a sophisticated name in Italy, and she's got a family with personal wealth. Herself, she's not particularly sophisticated. And, you know, there was no testimony taken by the Court of Chancery to really get into that and make conclusions about their credibility. The court was, one after another, refusing to cut them a break. And in many instances, they didn't deserve a lot of breaks.
Mr. Reed, the problem here is that this case is being reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard. And you're claiming that the abuse of discretion here was the entry of judgment on the merits of the claims rather than simply limiting the judgment to the amount of attorney's fees. Is that
correct.
Right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, if we're to find that that is an abuse of discretion, there has to be some principled reason for doing so. What would be the principled reason here?
Your Honor, let me take both issues. One, let's assume the fee sanction was appropriate, and we concede a fee sanction was appropriate. We're arguing about the difference between the 426 and the 7. Ultimately, a $700,000 fee award may be appropriate, but what we're saying, the court abused its discretion below by not doing a reasonableness review. The court simply awarded the entire $700,000 when we were contesting the difference between the 426 and the 7. On the critical issue,
if the court had simply awarded default judgment on the entire 7 but allowed your clients to go ahead and defend on the merits, would you be here?
If the court had entered judgment on the fee award and then allow us to defend on the merits?
That's correct.
I wouldn't be here.
All right. So let's move then to the question that I asked
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. And that is the critical question, Your Honor. And the standard is arbitrary and capriciousness on the part of the Vice Chancellor. I think that what that ultimately means is not whether another judge would have acted differently, but whether he did something outside the bounds of reasonableness in light of what was in front of him.
Why did he act outside the bounds of reasonableness?
Can it be the case that if these defendants were personally wealthy, that they paid the award and they would have moved on and they would have gotten their ruling on the merits? But because they couldn't, and most individuals couldn't, is it fair to them to say, okay, we're just going to default you? Clearly, it was the failure to pay the fee award that drove the Vice Chancellor to the default judgment.
You're well into your rebuttal time, which you're welcome to use.
I understand, Your Honor, and I this is the critical point, and I just wanted to sort of drive that home. If you look at the totality of the circumstances, we didn't put up a fight on this. We said, please enter it. We don't have the money to pay it. Enter it as a judgment. Let them pursue it, but give us a ruling on the merits, because a $10 million judgment, when they have no payment obligations, at least that's the ultimate issue, that issue should have been addressed. Because if they were wealthy, they would have gotten their ruling. This court could wipe out many of its appeals, I would suppose, if the condition was, before this court will hear you, you must actually, not just post a bond, you must actually pay your judgment. We think that is where the court abused.
Did you suggest a bond?
Well, we didn't post a bond on appeal, Your Honor.
No, I mean for the fee award.
No, that wasn't. Things happened so fast that opportunity that really didn't even come up as an option. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Joe DeSimone of Mayor Brown, and I represent the appellees and the plaintiffs below, Energy Coal and Italiana Coke. Now, the Court of Chancery did not abuse its discretion in entering a default judgment jointly and severally against Lucamina, Laura Garone, and Carbon Power for engaging in a continuous pattern of deliberate and willful discovery violations. Mina and Garone deliberately engaged in a serious pattern of discovery abuses that severely prejudiced plaintiffs' ability to litigate their claims in this matter. They willfully violated direct orders of the court on several occasions, and they misled the court on multiple occasions. Now, defendants, their conduct occurred in the underlying fraud litigation, principally in the months of October and November 2008. It continued when the settlement agreement was signed in December 5th, 2008, and then continued throughout the post-settlement litigation, December 2008 through March 2009.
Now, are there facts in the record to support this, or just representations made to the Vice Chancellor from which he drew conclusions?
There's several facts in the record, Your Honor. Let me go over some of them. For example, one of the first things they did was they, in October of 2008, they were supposed to respond to discovery requests that we propounded on them. This is in the underlying litigation. They failed to do so. And if you look at the record, in our appendix at page B40, we sent them a letter shortly thereafter saying, as of today, we've received nothing in response to the document requests in the form of a document production or a written response. Nor have defendants requested an extension of time or in any way acknowledged the deadline. And we go on to say, defendants are in default with respect to their discovery obligations. We also said that we gave them an extra week, till October 20th, to respond, or else we'd move to compel. Again, they didn't respond to this letter, just like they didn't produce the documents. And then they didn't respond on October 20th. In fact, we had to move to compel in December because of their non-response. Shortly thereafter that, November 19th and November 20th, they skipped their depositions. Duly noticed depositions that had been noticed for over a month. On the eve, on November 18th, I got a phone call saying that Garone and Mina simply would not be showing up. And they used the pretext of an airstrike in Italy. Now, the Court of Chancery, Judge Strine, saw through this excuse as pretextual. He called it ridiculous, and there's a lot of words in the record that he uses, very pejorative words. The strike affected only one airline, Alitalia, and the strike had been going on for over a week. It started, I think, the 12th. So it really wasn't a last-second thing that affected all the airlines. They clearly could have showed up. They just decided not to. With respect to producing documents, in addition to the October 9th date that they missed, right after the December 30th hearing before the court, where the judge said, look, we're having an expedited trial February 12th, and he set hearing dates, and then he set dates for producing documents. January 12th was the date they were supposed to produce all their documents. It was an expedited proceeding. They knew that. They had 12 days to produce their documents. And remember, in the end, they keep saying they produced a lot of documents. They produced 7,500 pages total. That's 2.5 boxes of documents. That's not a lot of documents. That's the total amount they produced throughout the whole litigation. And they should have done that on January 12th. They didn't do so.
7,500 pages may not be a lot of documents, but if they're the right documents, that's enough, isn't it?
That's true, Your Honor. And, you know, if we had gotten the right documents, we would have been perfectly happy with that. But as you know from the questioning of Mr. Reed before, they withheld key documents. Not only, and I'll get to that in a second, but let me just go back to the not producing. They didn't meet the January 12th deadline. They only produced a few documents. There was then, after that, a motion to compel file.
A few. Give us a ballpark.
250 pages. They just produced the tax returns of Carbon Power. That's it. No documents about Mina, no documents about Garone, no documents about emails and stuff about why potentially they didn't make the settlement payments, which they were supposed to make. Nothing. January 20th, we make a motion to compel. The judge is very upset with them, lays down a lot of rulings, and basically says, you have till January 30th to produce everything. Again, they missed that deadline. They produce very little on January 30th again, and then start a rolling production after the deadline in which they produce things out of bait stamped order. There were multiple gaps in the production. There were documents produced without bait stamps. They designated highly confidential large chunks of documents, including things like documents filed with the SEC that were clearly not confidential. And the judge at the February 4th hearing, when you know we had to again get the judge involved because they had done this and we couldn't prepare for the depositions.
Well, Mr. Reed concedes that a sanction was appropriate. So but why was the default appropriate?
Well, I think it's appropriate, Your Honor, for the reason that it wasn't an isolated instance here and there. It was a continuous pattern, starting in October, ending in March, that continued throughout. It had strategic reasons. They did it because they wanted to delay the proceedings. They wanted to put off first the February 12th trial date, which they were effective in putting off, because we couldn't even get our depositions done by then, nor did we get the documents. The judge was very upset about that because he had set the schedule. Then there was a March 2nd and 3rd trial date set, and they managed by their delay and obfuscation to push that trial date off. Again, the judge very upset about that. So there was severe prejudice to us in that we couldn't get the documents we needed to actually litigate the case because, and I'll go into this now, they were withholding critical documents.
You agree the test is not whether the judge is upset.
No, I understand that. Exactly, Your Honor. And I think when you go through the transcripts of the December 20th hearing, the January 20th hearing, the February 4th hearing, the February 25th hearing, these are four four conferences that the court had to schedule in a month or two because of multiple and persistent and a pattern of discovery abuses. You'll see that, you know, these are real abuses that are documented in the record. Like, for example, I showed you that reference to the documents in the record. All of them are in the motions to compel that we filed in the exhibits, you know, have references to the record. To letters that were breached.
Let me interrupt for a second here.
Sure.
This may be an oversimplification, but my sense of it from reading the transcript is that the trial court was attempting to have control over this litigation and enforce the rules and the rules of the court and the orders of the court with no success. Wait a second. And that ultimately, the trial court decided the only way I'm going to get these people attention is to let them know that either you listen to me this time or I'm defaulting the whole case. And apparently, even that wasn't enough. But what I'm trying to get at is it's one thing to be dealing with litigants who are not dealing with the litigation properly. It's another thing to sort of threaten the nuclear bomb and then actually detonate it. And usually the threat is enough to bring people to their senses. But here what it appears the trial court did is say, you know, I'm not able to get through to you people. I'm telling you, you've got to do these things. You're not doing them. You know, next time it's going to be over. Is that an appropriate way to deal with sanctions?
Well, I think it was a little more serious than Your Honor is saying in her question. There were, like I said, specific warnings given. It wasn't just at one conference or two conferences, at several conferences. Starting at the December 30th conference, he warned counsel that if they continued with the shenanigans, there would be serious consequences.
Okay, so he warned them several times, made the nuclear threat. But the question that Justice Berger asked was, given those warnings, was it an appropriate exercise of discretion to pull the fuse?
Well, I think it was, Your Honor. First, he tried lesser sanctions. He actually sanctioned Garone and said that a deposition had to be taken in Italy and she had to pay the costs. And even these lesser sanctions were ignored. So he tried the route of lesser sanctions. He tried the route of just threatening them.
The deposition occurred after that threat.
The deposition did occur, but they refused to notice the deposition in Italy, as he ordered them to do. And had we gone to Italy, she would have had to pay the costs. So she refused to comply with the order and got away with not paying the costs. Now, it's true that it did happen in New York. But, you know, what happened here, in February 25th, the judge said to them, look, there's enough in the record right now for me to default you. But I'm not going to do that. He had already warned them on the prior occasions. He tried lesser sanctions. On February 25th, he said, based on what's in the record, based on your egregious acts, I could default you. But I'm not going to do that. I'm going to give you yet another chance. And this is the theme here, that he kept giving them more chances. And he said, you know, pay the fees. And it wasn't just pay a whole bunch of fees. It was December 6th through February 25th. It was a narrow time frame. It didn't include the things that they did wrong in October and November. It didn't include the continuing things they did wrong in March.
Well, let me stop you on that. Opposing counsel suggests that they would have, but they just didn't have the money. If that is factually accurate, then that would have some bearing on their not complying with the court's order. I take it you have a different view?
I do, Your Honor. And if that were factually accurate, that would have been a factor that Judge Strand considered. It's not factually accurate. First of all, they didn't put in any kind of affidavit saying that they don't have the money to do this. Garone and Mina are both sophisticated, very wealthy individuals. Mina owns, and this came out in discovery, he owns over six houses in the United States, totaling over $2 million. He was paid over $400,000 by Carbon Power in the last 3 years. He put in $1 million to capitalize Carbon Power. He put in another $1 million to capitalize a restaurant that he owns in California. Ms. Garone put in $1 million of her personal money to capitalize Carbon Power. She put in $1.4 million of her personal money.
But you're saying there's no factual support for
that
statement?
Not at all, Your Honor.
Just a broader procedural question. Putting aside, whether or not the defendants intended to violate orders and make misrepresentations, are there any factual disagreements as far as the basic fundamental facts are concerned? That is, what happened?
Yes. Especially with respect to the merits. And, of course, the merits aren't the main thing here. But
no, I'm talking about the fundamental facts as in terms of what drove, what led to the default.
Well, I think that my adversary would blame it all pretty much on the non-payment of fees. I would say that that was one factor, and there were many other factors involved, too.
But that's not necessarily a disagreement about what happened. It may be a disagreement about the inferences that can be drawn from undisputed facts. I'm trying to determine whether the facts themselves are undisputed.
I think with respect to the discovery violations that are laid out very clearly in our brief and in our motion for default judgment, the facts are the facts. And the judge, you know, in his several transcripts at the conferences and then at the April 8th hearing, makes factual findings that really mirror what's in our briefs and what's in our motion for default judgment. So I don't think there's really a dispute there. And remember, I didn't hear anything from my adversary saying that not a single fact that the judge found finding was clearly erroneous. I didn't hear any mistake of law. All they're really arguing is...
There is a contention from the other side that they did not have the cash resources at the time to pay those fees.
Right.
So that's disputed, isn't it?
It's disputed, but I didn't hear him say that Judge Strine's finding on that was clearly erroneous, given that no affidavit was put in showing that they had no money, and given the facts that I gave you before, that in the record there's clear instances of the fact that they are very wealthy individuals.
Okay, but the dispute of that fact, was that before the Vice Chancellor, prior to the time that he entered the default?
Yes, Your Honor. It was in the briefing, and it was raised at oral argument.
That there was a dispute of fact on that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And was there any opportunity for, or should there be, any opportunity for testimony or a hearing of any kind?
I think based on really the indisputable facts in the record relating to their wealth and sophistication, a hearing would have been, I think, a waste of the court's time. And, the court did give them an opportunity to make a factual record by putting in an affidavit, which they chose not to do. So I don't think a hearing would have helped on that issue.
Okay. And where is the record site for that, the opportunity to make a factual record by affidavit? Was
It's in the April the April 8th transcript. The court goes over that.
So you're saying that they asserted that they couldn't afford to pay the attorney's fees but never put in any evidence that is admissible evidence to support that assertion. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. They did not put in an affidavit setting facts as to why they had no money, why they were indigent, because such an affidavit would have been, in fact, wrong, given the indisputable facts in the record that showed that they are wealthy individuals that have a lot of money and have a lot of personal assets.
Now, were there liquid assets? You had all of their financial statements. Was there information in there of liquid assets?
Again, Your Honor, one of the things that we didn't have was a complete record on that. For example, with Ms. Garone, we asked for, and the judge ordered them to produce, all our bank statements and other assets from 2004 to 2008. We got only 2008, and this is after months of arguing and begging to get the full record on that, and the court ordering them. Even in the end, they didn't order that. So based on the bank statements that we had in 2008, which are incomplete, it shows her having some assets, but it doesn't show, for example, other assets that she had. For example, the restaurant that she owns that she put $1.4 million into, there was a company called Omicron that she capitalized with her husband. There's Carbon Power, which she put $1 million into and capitalized with Mina. I mean, this is a sophisticated person who is an officer and director of several companies who regularly capitalizes companies by putting in millions of dollars in investments.
The facts that you just recited to Justice Ridgely, were they also argued to Vice Chancellor Stein?
They were in the record. I'm not sure they were argued at the April 8th hearing. I think I did. I would have to check the record on that. I think I probably said something exactly like what I just said to you about them being sophisticated, wealthy individuals and giving examples of that.
Okay, and those facts were not controverted?
No. And also, I'd like to throw in one other fact. You know, the basis of the underlying litigation here is that my client gave them $12 million to form two companies, Cobart and Oropaya. And, you know, for 2 years, 06 and 07, my clients on 12 separate occasions sent them written notice, many, many oral notices saying, please tell us what you've done with the money. They refused to respond. Again, like this litigation, they gave many excuses. We'll get back to you next week. We'll get you the information 2 weeks from now. I can't, you know, my client is on vacation. He can't get back to you. And finally, they had to hire an attorney. We made a formal demand under Delaware law as a director. And when we were given access to the books and records, they were incredibly incomplete. It didn't show what happened to the $12 million. And that's why we had to file the fraud complaint, because this money, in our view, was misappropriated. And, again, throughout the litigation, rather than, you know, go through discovery and have their clients sit for litigations, this is in the underlying litigation, they decided to settle right away. And it was a $12.5 million claim. They settled for just over $10 million. I think that speaks volumes about, you know, who's right and who's wrong in terms of the money being misappropriated. But, for example, they have that $12 million. You know, again, I don't know where it is. But one other point I'd like to make, which is a really important point, is that we were crippled in our ability to litigate the case because they withheld key documents on key issues. And this is after the judge ordered them to produce it. I'm talking about the up-the-line information on Bassani. Because remember, as to the ultimate merits, you know, my adversary's position is that that only Carbon Power had to pay. That's not what the contract says. The settlement agreement says Carbon Power or its affiliates shall pay. Our contention and what happened in the actual negotiations is that the controlling shareholders, directors and owners of Carbon Power, that is Mina and Garone, are affiliates. So they're clearly covered by that. And remember, they got a release of over $12 million in potential damages for signing that document. Carbon Power was not even a defendant in that litigation, the fraud litigation for $12 million. It was just Mina and Garone. Carbon Power was a defendant in a separate litigation for only $900,000. So in our view, you know, the merits, we think a reading of the agreement shows pretty clearly that Mina and Garone are covered. They were jointly and severally liable. And, you know, they're...
Mr. DeSimone, because of the constraints of time, let me just get to the bottom line. Is it a fair statement of your position that the Vice Chancellor did not abuse his discretion in entering a default judgment on the merits because over a series of events he gave the other side every opportunity to comply and imposed a series of lesser sanctions until it reached the point where he could reasonably conclude that that would not work.
That is absolutely a correct representation of what happened, Your Honor. There were serious abuses over a long period of time that went to the heart of our ability to litigate the case. We couldn't litigate it, and the Vice Chancellor lost all real respect in the other side's ability to be truthful, as he was lied to on occasion after occasion. Thank you, Your Honor.
I don't want to be litigating things that occurred prior to the settlement agreement. Settlement agreement was entered, and there's a dispute about who's an affiliate. The agreement's very clear about who pays who. That's the thing we ultimately wanted the ruling on. There were not a series of threats that the parties disregarded. The first sanction was ordering the payment of the fees for counsel to go to Italy. It was because the court thought it was a ridiculous explanation that her passport expired. But she nonetheless got her passport renewed and, for their convenience, showed up in New York and was deposed. The second threat was the nuclear threat that Justice Berger talked about. That was it really was unnecessary. We were involved in the case at that time. We were going back. We were reproducing documents, putting base stamps on them, trying to clean up production, making sure everything that was there was produced. Most of it was over 7,000 pages. The threat didn't, by the time the court acted on that threat and pushed the button on that nuclear bomb, the stuff had been produced. The Busani agreement had been produced. The underlying stock certificates had been produced.
The April 8th transcript will show that the opportunity to demonstrate that your clients did not have the liquidity to pay on time was presented and yet not taken advantage of.
I had absolutely no idea that the court was going to want that kind of evidence. I responded to the court's order that said, pay the fees that are reasonable and file a certification as it relates to the remainder. I quote that on page 9 of our brief because I was concerned about that. I was trying to explain to the court, I don't want to be held in contempt. I made a certification. They had all the financial records. They can't point to a single bank account that these folks produced showing available cash to pay this.
Well,
they may suspect, but that's not the record.
Wasn't the burden on your clients at this point to respond to an order that they could not comply with some kind of evidence or affidavit?
Your Honor, if I may continue, I think yes. I can't demonstrate what doesn't exist. They had the bank accounts, and I filed a certification of counsel, saying that, best of my knowledge, they do not have the ability as of today to make this kind of payment. I don't understand what would have been wrong with entering judgment on them. Let the folks pursue it. Let the folks go out and do what folks do, asset searches, and try to collect on that judgment. But why the failure to pay $426,000 results in a $10 million judgment on an agreement where there is a substantial question about whether they owe $10 million was fair? Because if they had it, we certainly would have paid it
to
get to the merits.
We appreciate the arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement.
Thank you.